Say you have all your agency and you are telling the person these things, but they don't see it that way.
You're up against a system that is actually not designed for you. It's not designed for patients. It's not designed to treat the invisible parts of suffering,
yeah.
Things you can't measure in a blood test.
Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Tina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl, Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. And today, we're going to ask a deceptively simple question. What does it actually mean to take charge of your health? Because we're living in a very strange time in medicine. And on the one hand, we have so much medical information out there. We have specialists. We have wearable data. We have testing. We have all sorts of things. More access to your own medical record than you even imagine. And yet patients often tell me they feel less heard and they have less access. And medicine has become, you know, really sophisticated at sort of the body of medicine and in our understanding, but sometimes listening is lost in the process. And so there's actually a really old concept in medicine, and I've talked about this on this podcast before, called the clinical gaze, which is the idea that medicine learns to translate the human beings in front of them into their finding, right? I used to joke that I treat from the belly button to the mid thigh, because that was like my area of OBGYN. And obviously you're missing the point if you're not seeing the patient as a whole, if you're just looking at the lab value or the diagnosis or the organ system that you treat. And so what gets lost in that clinical gaze is it religion? Is it trauma? Is it sexuality? Is it where are we looking at? And so today, my guest is amazing Dr. Lucy McBride, who argues that some of those things aren't peripheral to health, but they are health. And she and I align in so many ways when we talk about so many of the things, and I'm super excited to have her. Dr. McBride is a primary care physician and co-founder of the Ackerley McBride Group in Washington, D.C. For over 25 years, she has practiced evidence-based, relationship-centered medicine. She's a graduate of Princeton and Harvard Medical School with a master's degree in pharmacology from Cambridge as a Fulbright Scholar. She completed her internal medicine residency at Johns Hopkins, and she writes the weekly newsletter, Are You Okay? Which is how I found her, because one day I wasn't okay. And when it said, when her newsletter said, Are you okay? I was like, no, can't tell me why.
That's right. That's right.
Anyway, and she's all of us. I'm super excited to talk to her today about her new book that has just launched, Beyond the Prescription. Her work has appeared in all sorts of areas. You guys will read about it in her bio that I'm going to post. But I'm super excited to have you on, Lucy.
Samuel, yay, thank you for having me. Thanks for having me. It's crazy. It's publication week. It's crazy. It's going really well.
Yeah. And
I'm just grateful to talk with you. I mean, the best part of launching this book is connecting with other women doctors, with people out there who feel disenfranchised from the medical system or even from their own bodies, who are looking for guides and really a playbook on how to squeeze the juice out of that 15-minute transactional doctor's appointment. That's what this book is for.
Yes.
To say to you, look, the medical system is failing you. It treats you like a bag of organs, a set of diagnosis codes. And the wellness industry is giving you the illusion
Praying
of control.
On you.
Yeah. The illusion of control and certainty without accountability. And so there's a middle path. There's a way to be more empowered. I'm not suggesting you be your own doctor. The solution isn't to be your own doctor. It's to be a more empowered patient.
Exactly.
And what that does require is self-awareness at its core. So it turns out that when you ask yourself hard questions and you're honest with yourself about your past, your current life situation, your stressors, and you start to connect the dots between your childhood experience and your relationship with food and your diabetes, then you can actually bring a more authentic rendering of yourself to your doctor's office. You can ask sharper questions. You can understand your needs on a deeper level, because health is about more than just a normal cholesterol and a normal BMI, as you well know, Samina.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm Gyno Girl on Instagram, so I love a good backstory. So tell me, like, what's your backstory? Like, what brought you into this area of medicine? What made you write a book? Like, what was going through your head? And then we'll talk about the book itself.
So when I was doing my training, I realized that medicine is extremely good at treating the disease, but less good at treating the person who has it.
100%.
And I wanted to be that person, that first point of contact which is primary care, to understand that your grief and your loss has everything to do with your blood pressure being high. You know, it may also be genetics. It may also be bad luck. It may also be something else. But that humanism in medicine is really the art of caring for humans, right?
Yeah.
And that was being lost. And so I wanted to be that doctor. I also wanted to help other doctors realize their potential, which is what I do now in my practice, and help patients one at a time recognize that they are more than just the sum total of their lab tests or their step tracker or their protein grams, right?
Yeah,
And also to impart the message that we have much more control over our health than we are made to believe. That there's so much agency to be gained. It's just that we need to accept the parts of our health we can't control, which is hard, to be able to allocate energy to the areas we do have control. I started writing during the panic spring of 2020. Before 2020, I was just a doctor going about my life, raising three children. In the panic spring of 2020, I started writing a newsletter to my family and patients, just like updating them with what my thoughts were about the pandemic and, you know, what to do.
Yeah.
That newsletter took off. It's now reaching 41,000 people a week on Substack. Thank God I'm not writing about COVID all the time. I'm writing about how to make sense of, you know,
everything you're hearing.
Or hormone replacement therapy, or can I take hormones if I've had breast cancer? I'm trying to help people. I'm not influenced by politics or ideology. I mean, I don't think I'm trying to be an unbiased guy to talk straight to people about reconceptualizing health. My book, therefore, was born out of seeing what my newsletter readers were asking me about, hearing what my patients are asking me about for 20 plus years, and realizing that people are starved for basic information. And this is not a do as I say book. This is a here's how to think book. Here's how to be a smarter, more empowered, self-aware agent of change for yourself and ultimately for the system, because one empowered patient at a time is how we start to affect change on a more on a national level, right? So like, I mean, we need to reinvent healthcare to serve everybody, right? Yeah. And primary care should be the crown jewel of medicine, not the stepchild, but that's another conversation. Yeah.
That's another conversation. I want to talk about your concept of health agency too, because, you know, I always talk about some of the same concepts in a different lens, I feel like, because, you know, I want to push the idea a little bit today, because not everybody has the same ability to exercise their agency.
Right.
And so there's a concept of cultural health capital that is talked about a lot, which is like your repertoire of knowledge, your ability to communicate, your ability to describe your pain the way you're, so that your physician can understand it, the resources you may have. They're all different. It's different depending on, you know, really some of the social determinants of health that we talk about.
Right.
And so like, how can we, because, and we know part of that is clinician bias and implicit bias and the system that has been built on sort of the systemic systems that have impeded like people from across the board. And so I think what's interesting and what's hard, I think, is to talk about healthcare agency for someone who may have it, but is not heard on the other side. Right.
Right. So agency, having health agency to me is two parts. It's having access to doctors and care, which, as we know, is not equitably accessible to people in the United States of America. So that's one thing. But what I'm talking about in this book is access to all of the information you house in your own body and mind, in your story. Like, doctors love to think about biometric data. We can test you up the yin-yang for diseases and cancer markers and blood-based biomarkers for Alzheimer's. But we don't do a good job of understanding your biography. And my point about health agency, one of my points about health agency, is that only you have access to your story, the facts of your biography, and separately, but perhaps related, is the stories you are telling yourself about what you deserve, the shoulds, are you telling yourself that you don't deserve to feel better, I should lose weight, when actually maybe weight isn't even a problem or isn't something that you're going to solve overnight? Are you telling yourself, I'm not the kind of person who, fill in the blank, takes Prozac, pigs' hormones asks for help. The stories that we tell ourselves, the narratives that we create about our own bodies, about our own worthiness, about our health, plus our actual facts of our biography, like I was born in poverty, or I was raised by a bullying, abusive mom, or I was teased about my weight in high school, or I, you know, self-medicate with alcohol. All of those stories you have access to. But we don't, as physicians, have time to ask you those kinds of questions, have the knowledge or training to be able to connect the dots between the story you've told yourself about worthiness and your propensity to binge eat.
Yes.
And that how that relates to your lab test. So what I'm asking you to do in this book, and I'll put it up here again, you know, we're trained as doctors, not marketers, but I've got to beyond the prescription.
Yeah.
Is you are the only one who has access to your whole story, the narratives you tell yourself. So what I'm asking you to do is ask yourself a whole set of questions so your doctor doesn't have time to ask you. Self-reflection and self-awareness is a superpower. And then that's the birthplace of agency. When a patient, for example, told me 6 months ago, when she was refusing to get a mammogram, refusing to see her GYN, and I thought it was just another, like, she's busy. And that was kind of her excuse on the surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I was about to do a breast exam, she pulled away from me and I just paused and I was like, let me ask you something. I've known her for a long time. And I was like, do you have any history of sexual trauma? Tears come down.
Yeah.
And I just asked her directly. And she's like, thank you for asking me that because I have been ashamed to talk about it. And you're the first person in medicine to ask me that question. Now, that's very sad because first of all, it's incredibly common. But the solution to her getting her mammogram wasn't me lecturing her or giving her another order. It was helping her understand her relationship with her body, giving her some tools to practice self-compassion. And, you know, she may need to do some therapy for trauma related, you know, like trauma-informed therapy to help her prevent breast cancer and get her mammogram or see the gynecologist. So I think that, you know, medicine is, again, wonderful at treating the diseases, less good at treating the person. And it's only when you understand the connection between who you are, how you think, how you feel, and how you behave that you can, you know, good and bad or ideal or not ideal, that you can start to connect the dots and then understand yourself in a more holistic way. That's what medicine should be doing, but we just don't have the capacity to in the current system. So that's health agency. Yeah. And then, you know, getting yourself to a doctor who can understand you in that nuanced way, good luck.
Yeah.
But at a minimum, if you can understand yourself, then you're going to ask sharper questions to your doctor. You could go into your gynecologist. I'm helping this patient rehearse this to let her gynecologist know that she has had sexual trauma to then help frame that visit.
Right.
I mean, that's step one. Give herself the permission and the courage to have that conversation and not to have to be asked.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that is part of like our broken system in that, you know, so many people don't address some of these elephants in the room.
Right.
You know, for those of us, you know, with more nuanced practices, we're able to. But like, I think in a traditional, and I've been in a traditional academic practice with the 15-minute visits and the other things,
right.
And it's exceptionally difficult. I think one of the issues is, you know, like say you have all your agency and you are telling the person these things, but they don't see it that way. Do you know what I'm saying? Because I have patients with me, they're like, okay, you know, I've done this X, Y, and Z, but, you know, I'm either not believed or I don't, you know. And so I think that, like, you know, a patient can do all of that, but then verbalizing to that clinician, right? Like, I don't think you understand. I am a South Asian woman. I will die from a heart attack for, you know, like these kind of things that, you know. I agree with you, like, that agency is so important. But also, it's important for the clinician in front of you to understand
100%.
Where their positionality is compared to your positionality.
You're up against a system that is actually not designed for you. It's not designed for patients. It's not designed to treat the invisible parts of suffering, things you can't measure in a blood test. You know, the system is not designed to treat you, the patient. It's not designed to countenance things we can't measure in a blood test. But doctors want to be empathetic. We want to understand.
That's what we went into, right?
We didn't go into medicine to treat body parts. We went in to treat whole people. So I think, and I know this is putting a lot of onus on the patient. I really do. But this is just where we are. Is practicing your communication skills And recognizing that doctors are people too, it goes a long way. For example, if you say to a doctor, look, I know there are so many constraints on your time. I know you have 15 minutes for me and that the thing I'm complaining about, you can't see in a blood test. I understand that. And I, you know, feel for you. I also wonder if we could have a conversation about this. There's a little more deeper dive. And I'd love to have a follow-up conversation and I'll make an appointment on my way out because I know you only have 15 minutes right now.
Yeah.
Just advocate.
Or even if you're not able to do it, tell me someone that you know that can.
Yeah.
Right?
Or like, who do you know? Who would you go to if you were suffering from menopausal symptoms and you'd been in, and you don't, understandably, you weren't trained in menopause care because not a lot of doctors were. Nobody I don't blame you for that. But like, who should I go to? Right.
Right.
I mean, I think doctors, when given like a nod to our humanism, are likely to be empathetic.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's like a good thing. I'm not saying that you're trying, you should like, you know, heal us. I'm just saying that that is the reality. Just nodding to our humanism helps us. It just disarms the conversation. It just disarms the conversation. And there's nothing better than a self-aware patient. When a patient comes in to see me and they're like,
I love it.
I'm a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. I'm a black and white thinker. I don't think in gray areas. So
you can understand that person.
Right? Totally.
Yeah.
And I talk about in the book, I talk about the patient personality, not to indict people or pigeonhole people, but because we all have these sort of versions of ourselves that show up in the doctor's office. Are you the people pleaser who thinks to themselves, if I can just get the doctor to like me, everything will be okay. If you know you're that person, you can then go to your doctor and say, look, I've been shamed by doctors and I tend to want to be a people pleaser or another type of patient. And so I want to know that I want to partner with you. So like, just know that about me and it's not about you. That goes a long way.
Yeah, it does. It totally does. Yeah, you talk about all the different types of patients. Want to listen?
Yeah.
Oh, that was so interesting.
So the people pleaser, the optimizer who believes that willpower guarantees outcome, that you can like step track your way out of like heart disease. The internet warrior who's up all night on ChatGPT Googling their symptoms and anxious and understandably so. And then the outsourcer who doesn't really want the mechanism, trusts doctors maybe too much. And is like, I just want the prescription, the pill, and like get out of there.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting about even, AI in the ChatGPT world is I had a conversation with a patient who was neurodivergent recently, and she was going to see an ENT specialist. And I was like, you know, warning her about ChatGPT and da da da. And she's like, Dr. Mon, you don't understand. I had vocabulary for once that I didn't have from ChatGPT.
It's great.
My appointment went so seamlessly because what you told them what they wanted to hear to get the answer that you wanted? Or was it like, she's like, no, I didn't know the words to describe what I was feeling.
So that's the utility of AI. Everyone's using AI right now. Like and you're probably doing it right now. Like if you're listening, you're like, what's that rash on my leg? You're taking a screenshot of it and then putting it on ChatGPT. The best use of AI is not necessarily asking it the question and getting the answer, because health isn't about having all the answers. And while AI is excellent at answering the question you ask it, the art is surfacing the question that you mean to be asking.
Yeah.
So if you can ask it to ask you smarter questions, to probe deeper and ask it to ask you what you're missing, and then learn a vocabulary with which to then advocate for yourself in the doctor's office, that's the best use of it. Like as a master question generator, as like a coach to ask you better questions.
100%. Yeah. I mean, you bring up the topic of the patient who thinks that they should just listen to their doctor empirically and whatever. And just reminds me of something I like to talk about a lot, which is like epistemic justice or epistemic injustice, right? Which like who gets to be considered credible and like the immediate sort of power dynamic that for some people feel, right? And I feel like that's where one aspect of like social media has like humanized some of us so that like there's not this big feeling of like, okay, you're up here and I'm down here. But, and I know you kind of write about marginalized populations a little bit in your book as well. I think that, and I feel like maybe you and I should get together for this next section. It's like, we talk about health agency for the patient, but how are we going to make those clinicians more humble to like hear this agency, right? Like how, because it is, it's putting the onus on the patient, which is difficult, right?
I think that we need to, I mean, there's so many layers to that question, Samina, but I think medical education needs to continue educating medical students and residents on the humanities and the human experience of illness.
We need to educate the people that are 10, 15, 20. I mean, I'm 20 years old.
So that's it. I also think that what we need, like our generation of doctors, is to be humble about what we don't know. For example, you take the cohort of doctors who weren't educated about hormone replacement therapy. That includes me. So I was not educated about hormone therapy. I don't think menopause was a word that was used at Harvard Medical School in the 1990s. So I had to educate myself. You see this whole cohort of physicians out there in the public square sort of like doubling down on hormone therapy. Instead of being humble about what they didn't learn, didn't know, they're digging their heels in. It feels like a proxy for the shame they have about not knowing about it and saying, well, hormone therapy is not all that. Hormone therapy is being over. Well, sure, it's being over prescribed. Perhaps it's also been under prescribed. That's more of the injustice.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, we are people too. We also, I think a lot of us are ashamed of our lack of time with patients. We're ashamed of our profession that we've misled women. We've misled marginalized populations that, you know, we've mistreated patients. I think there's a lot of shame. I really, really do, actually. And I think shame can manifest itself as humility and a dedication to educating ourselves and re-educating ourselves and an openness and a flexibility and a cognitive flexibility. I also think it can cause doctors who don't like being told they didn't know something or don't like not knowing what the diagnosis is and they don't have time. It's very easy for us to be like, well, not my problem. Move on to the next patient. So I think we could use a little bit of more humility, more permission to be human.
Beyond writing the prescription.
And more self-forgiveness for not knowing everything. I think that would go a long way. It's only when I've been a patient, it's not only when I've been a patient, but it's largely when I've been a patient myself that I realize how vulnerable it is to be unwell and how the medical system just processes you like a widget on a conveyor belt. I mean, when I was in my 20s and 30s, I was sick and I saw every specialist. I saw a neurologist and, you know, all these different doctors. And I was told I didn't have a Giardia and I didn't have a brain tumor. And no one asked me the basic question, how are you? Are you okay? That's the title of my newsletter.
Yeah.
No one asked me, oh, how do you manage stress? What's the story you tell yourself about, you know, your self-worth, which had everything to do with why I didn't feel well physically. The point is, I think that we as doctors need to, you know, forgive ourselves for not having all the time and forgive ourselves for not knowing everything and just do the best we can and center the patient in front of us and not our own egos.
Right, right. And I think that's where the learning comes, I feel like, because, you know, it's the patient's advocacy. And I think the work that's being done right now that is waking up societies, right? Like, you know, how many times was I told in training that the service has no nerve endings and, you know, that patients don't need IUD pain medication. And it literally took people TikToking their IUD insertions for these bodies of like, you know, how CDC, the American College of Rheumatology, wake up and say, oh, you know what? Maybe we should think about pain medication for a procedure that impacts, you know, internal organs that are so innervated that people pass out when they have these procedures.
Right.
You know?
I also
Which is something
that
I learned in practice. Like, I was like, oh, these people are passing out. They need pain medicine.
Yeah. I also think that doctors, we are deemed the problem by many patients. We are deemed... So I think that like there's a lot of anger, there's shame on our part, but there's also anger. I think physicians are feeling, I mean, first of all, the class of 2025, med school class of 2025, on average had a debt coming out of school of $200,000 to $250,000. And then you go into the field and you're realized what practicing medicine actually looks like. It's a lot of administrative grunt work. It's a lot of, and it's a lot of patients who are sick and upset with the system. And they think that you're the reason. They think that you're part of the problem when you just went into medicine to care for patients. So I think there's a lot of anger among physicians who feel blamed by their patients or making them wait a long time or not getting back to them on time or not answering that portal message. And so burnout is rampant. And the sad part about it is that it's not the patient's fault that they're complaining. They have a right to get care. And it's not the doctor's fault that they're burned out and overworked and, you know, underpaid, at least in primary care. Mm-hmm. It's the system's fault. So instead of fighting each other or assuming as a physician that your patient who comes in with like the spreadsheet or the list of questions from the online influencer, instead of making them feel bad that they are empowered and interested in being a partner, understand where they're coming from. They're just trying to do the best they can, just like you are. Mm-hmm. And I think we could use a lot of education in our generation of doctors about that.
100%.
Self-compassion, partnership, giving yourself a break, and knowing that patients aren't trying to be obnoxious. They're just don't know who to complain to.
Yeah. And it's like, and you have to think about the patients who have been dismissed 6, 7, 8 times. It takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to come forward every single time, expecting to get dismissed again, right? Like, and so I think that's important for us to remember on this side as well.
That's absolutely right. It's so interesting, Samina. I'm seeing a lot of ire online about, and like I've seen these videos where people subvert, they take a video of their doctor telling them that like they have anxiety and their physical symptoms are for anxiety. And the internet goes wild saying this, how dare this physician suggest that this is all in your head, or how dare your physician tell you that it's, you know, and I think that is such an interesting cultural moment, because what it speaks to is patients are so pissed off of being dismissed and talked over, and they have a right to feel pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, this is a communication problem, because sometimes your migraine headaches or your back pain or your abdominal pain or your chest pain or your chronic fatigue has a lot to do with your stress and your anxiety, because the problem
every
so much
vulval vaginal patient that I have and chronic vulval vaginal pain is anxious and they're depressed.
Right. So like,
why wouldn't you be?
Of course. So I think the problem is lost in the translation. It's not that maybe the doctor was a jerk that day and that person should have been videotaped and fired. Right. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of doctors who are trying to communicate the fact that, like, you know, you don't have coronary disease, you don't have ovarian cancer as a cause for your chest or pelvic pain, maybe it's an anxiety phenomenon, maybe it's something you need to work on, comes across as a dismissal, when actually, if it was phrased better and it was an anxiety and was conceptualized by the doctor first as something that's as important as preventative health and heart health, and they had more ability to talk about it, and they asked questions instead of like accusing someone of being anxious, we would go a long way. So I think it's very interesting. I think so much of it comes down to just poor communication between patients and doctors. And this book is really aimed to help you be a better communicator, to be a better self-advocate. And some of that includes communicating with your doctor, who may not be as self-aware as you are.
Yes, 100%. 100%. And I mean, a lot of that, what you're talking about too, speaks to the stigmas that we have associated with diseases, right? Like,
oh, yes.
You can have a cancer and, you know, the world is very upset and sad and want to do everything we can. And I'm not dismissing cancer's, you know, a big deal. But so is, you know, an anxiety attack that debilitates you from going to work, or major depressive episode that makes you want to, like, not go to school, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But we've stigmatized mental health so much that it's a you problem. No, it is a neurobiochemical issue happening, right?
That's like, right.
If we treat it as a disease, just like heart attacks and strokes and other things, then there would, you know what I'm saying? Like, and the same with sexual health. I feel the same way. Like, sexual health is health. It's, you know, we see things that happening in your sexual health world that are reflective of your cardiovascular, your diet, you know, whatever. But it's just,
I mean, I think what happens is that when a physician is aware or hypothesizes that someone's physical problems stem from emotional issues, the default is, oh, it's just in your head, or some messaging that suggests that to the patient. When you wouldn't say to a heart failure patient, oh, it's just your heart, and then send you at the door, right? No, you'd be like, okay.
Right. Heart, dude.
It's just your heart. It's just your heart. It's just doing that thing again.
Yeah.
That would be a dismissal, right? No, you'd say, oh, it's your heart. So let's work on, you know, getting you on Lipitor, getting you on blood pressure medicine. Let's get you an exercise program and talk about eating. Yeah. Similarly, doctors would go a long way if they're going to suggest that anxiety or mood or has something to do with your symptoms. Don't just say, well, that's just anxiety, or that's just your mood, or that frame it.
This is a big deal.
As an issue that needs to be countenanced just like any other medical issue. But we lack education on how to help people with their mental health.
Yeah.
I think at the risk of medicalizing normal experiences, right? Like, it's easier for me to write a prescription for Prozac than it is to say, hey, what's going on in your life? And help someone with a relationship that's toxic, that's bogging them down, you know, a toxic boss or a bad spouse or an abusive partner.
Yeah.
Prozac isn't going to fix that. So the goal here is for better communication between patient and doctor.
Yeah.
And to then help you have tools to manage whatever it is you have, whether it's situational, biological, behavioral, mental, physical.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what's trending now with, who's the lady that's had postpartum psychosis and,
Lindsay Clancy.
Lindsay Clancy. Yeah.
Oh my God. Like, so sad. It's just so sad.
And she had a very traumatic sort of issue that was happening to her related to biologic processes and all the things. And what could have happened if an intervention had been in place with better communication, right?
100%. It is 100% a communication problem. I mean, it's an access to medical and mental health care. There's so many hard parts of it, and there's no way to say what's harder than others, but it is very difficult as a clinician to watch someone have been just lost in our system. And then also to see the grilling of these psychiatrists, you know, these psychiatrists who, you know, may have done wrong. I don't know all the facts of the case. Problem here is access, communication, and appreciation of mental health as ground zero for our whole health.
Ground zero, right? And this is, we know it's one of the main issues in the postpartum realm that really can, like, you know, feed into maternal mortality rates, right? And so these are, and other mortality rates, obviously. And so I think this is such an important thing that we're talking about, because it's like, you know, had we in our training or our understanding or like, and you have to like chop away at history for this, right? Because hysteria, the uterus, like, you know, go back in time, and what people always blamed everything for women was, you know, that. And so, like, you know, this is really hard to unravel a system that's been in place for hundreds of years.
Yes.
Doesn't mean that we cannot try and do better and use communication skills like you described.
Yes.
And I think, you know, some of my best learning has been from, you know, a communications social scientist expert friend of mine, Janine Anderson, who really flipped the script in my head on like how I should be communicating sexual health, particularly with the most marginalized groups. And so I think that this speaks to the greater issues that we're having in healthcare that can, and again, helping the most marginalized will help everyone. So I think that
100%.
But I think that, you know, and so this is what I love so much about the book that you wrote. And I was reading the PDF. I haven't gotten the real copy yet, but the PDF of it was, you know, it's just really, you know, knowing who you are, knowing the type of patient you are, trying to be sort of the person in charge of your healthcare, even though it's a big deal, right? But
it's a big ask, but no one is coming to save you in the medical system, unfortunately.
Yes.
And particularly for people who don't have access to a primary care medical home where your doctor knows your name, not just your diagnosis codes, you really have to be educated about your story, your goals, your needs, your tolerances for risk.
Yeah.
So not everybody's going to choose the same path when given the option to, you know, lifestyle versus medication. And so it's not on me to tell you what you should do. It's really on me to tell you what the options are. And then for you to have understood from the get-go what your goals are, what your tolerance for risk is. Because trade-offs are part of health. There are no solutions. They're just trade-offs, right? Mm-hmm. Risk lives on both sides of every decision.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, there are risks of taking hormone replacement therapy. There are risks of not being on hormone replacement therapy. So we want to center your goals first. And only you know what your goals are, your tolerance for risk.
And that's why I think, you know, what makes medicine hard these days is, you know, like, I now in the last year converted my practice to concierge, so I am able to like really give nuanced care to my patients, right? Because I'm not dependent on an insurance company to tell me whether or not I can or cannot diagnose and treat that and get anything to help me keep my doors open, right?
Like, right.
So,
right.
And so I think Like, you know, we can teach patients how to speak. We have to teach clinicians how to listen. And it's hard to do in the system that we're in.
Yeah. I mean, we need massive system-wide reform. I don't think in the U.S. it's going to happen in the federal government just because it's slow and there's too much risk associated with like major changes and innovation in healthcare in particular. But I think Silicon Valley, if it partners with medicine, could actually help. Believe me, I'm the first person to be suspicious of Silicon Valley and the tech bros and that whole world. Yeah. But to the extent that AI is here, it's coming at medicine, whether we like it or not. I think the hope to me is that we point AI at the grunt work, the prior auth,
the
administrative burden that has really hollowed out primary care to allow the patient-doctor experience, the patient-doctor relationship, the communication, the conversation to be elevated, not eliminated. And if you scale that kind of model on a national scale, then we're really doing
something. Yeah, exactly. When we talk about sort of what are the tools you would tell your patients or readers to listen to kind of embody, what are you hoping that they get from your book?
So I hope they come away with three things specifically. One is feeling less alone. Like you haven't failed the system. The system is failing you. It's not doctor's fault. It's definitely not your fault. Number two, I hope you come away with a vocabulary. What's that?
I said it's the insurance company's fault.
It is. I mean, we need health insurance, but we also don't need the insurance companies to call us. We need insurance companies. We don't want insurance companies to tell us what health is or what we need or what our goals are. Yes. We need your doctor and you to make those decisions one at a time. And then secondly, I hope people come away with the vocabulary with which to talk about themselves, to understand themselves.
Yeah.
And then a set of questions to bring to their doctor that are sharper, more nuanced, and that reflect your pain points, your actual problems.
Right.
Sometimes it's the question beneath the question you should be asked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what are you embarrassed to say out loud? What is your pain point? Where are you stuck? So gone are the days where you could just show up to the doctor and expect them to help you. You really have to be engaged, empowered with vocabulary and a heavy dose of self-awareness.
100%. And I think that's what I like about the patients I see. You know, you have the memes about you can't Google your MD, whatever it is. But I actually love the patients come in with all the, I read this article. Did you do this? And I'm like, yeah, let me see. Oh, I don't know about that one. Do you want to tell me about it? Or like, you know, I'm not sure if I'm the right person, but I'm going to sure as hell try to get you the right person, you know?
And sometimes people are coming in. I think doctors are quick to assume that the person who comes in with articles doesn't trust the doctor, that they trust only the writer of the article. But sometimes patients just want a quick reassurance that that doesn't apply to them. Or they want to be told, you don't need that test.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a patient came in to ask me if she should get the APOE4 gene mutation test because her mother had Alzheimer's. She's 55 or something. Yeah. I was like, you don't need it because you don't have cognitive decline, and getting a genetic test that doesn't predict your future is just going to make you anxious every time you lose your car keys. And she was like, okay, done.
Yeah.
But if you just dismiss people and say like, oh, I'm the expert, like, why are you looking up all this stuff? First of all, you're depriving people of just like what normal people do. And then you're just being dismissive.
A jerk.
Because everybody, I mean, an informed patient is an empowered patient. If you tend to, if you're not reassurable and you're someone who's like, doesn't trust your doctor to give you the answers and you only trust ChatGPT and AI and you do your own research, that's a trust problem, not a medical problem, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. 100%. Yeah. So, and, you know, to your point, I think that trust problem exists in a lot of communities and things that, you know, you can understand why they don't trust, right?
Like,
you know, in the most marginalized communities, in our Black women communities, they do not trust because why should they?
You need to
tell me why I should trust you, because you know, this is an error. You know, some of these people are born and lived through, you know, the Mississippi appendectomies, or like, you know, people had their 100%. Uteruses removed instead of their appendix.
I mean, I'm a big believer in you know, we should never assume anything about another person, right? Mm-hmm. So doctors make assumptions about patients all the time, right? Like we have cognitive bias, right? Like everybody else. I think patients assume things about us for good reason. Yeah. Like we have abused populations. There's a history of abuse and neglect of marginalized populations, women. I mean, it just goes on.
Yeah.
So, but I think on an individual, on a very human level, I think the honest thing you can do is to give the person the benefit of the doubt first.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't assume that a person you're first meeting, whether it's a patient and you're the doctor or you're, you know, the other way around, that this person is going to dismiss you or judge you. I think go in with questions, go in with the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll be convinced that this person is not to be trusted. But I think coming in a non-adversarial way when you don't know this person from Adam and remembering that this is a human too.
Yeah.
Patient to doctor, doctor to patient. These are humans. Someone who wants to be helped and who wants your help.
Yeah.
That just small nugget can help kind of disarm the conversation and take it from being adversarial and the doctor getting back in their corner and the patient feeling like, well, then they're defensive, so then they can't be trusted. That changes the dynamic. It changes the energy in the room.
Yep. Yep. This happened recently in my office when a patient of mine, she's a Black patient, and got pregnant. And I was like, well, I don't do OB anymore. I'm going to have to send you off. And she started crying because of the idea of maternal mortality. Right. You listen to me. I'm afraid someone else is not. And I was like, listen, you have to believe that the majority of people that enter this profession really. And I said, you know, I'm going to tell you some things to help you advocate for yourself.
Yes. There you go.
We know that this exists and we know it's not just a doctor. It might be the nurse. It might be the, you know, assistant, you know, whatever that bias that might start and kind of transcends and enters the space. And so how are you going to get your best advocacy? And that's what we have to talk about.
Yeah. And sometimes the best prescription you can give someone, Samina, is a prescription for that vocabulary. It's not for medicine. It's for the vocabulary.
Yes.
It's for permission to ask a question that you're embarrassed to ask or afraid to ask. It's permission to not settle for less than someone who cares for you as a person.
Right.
It's a tall order, but it's not impossible.
Right.
It's not impossible. I mean, there are wonderful doctors out there and, you know, we are people too and burnt out and tend to go back into our corners because we're upset or burnt out or ashamed. So I think a little empathy on both sides goes a long way. But trust is at the core of any patient doctor relationship, and you deserve to feel like you trust your doctor, and hopefully it goes both ways.
Right, Melissa. I think we leave it at that because I want that to be the last word, that we should trust, we should feel like we can trust our doctor or clinician, and we should also trust what our patient is
trust
saying.
Trust but verify. Yeah. I'm not saying that blindly trust. I'm saying go in if you can with an openness and in a non-adversarial way, like sort of a, like assume best intentions, give people the benefit of the doubt. And then of course, verify, right?
Yeah.
You're allowed to not trust your provider, but I wouldn't go in assuming they're untrustworthy when you haven't met them, right? Give them a chance. And same thing with doctors, give patients a chance, right? They're doing the best they can too.
Yes, 100%. Well, this is great. Lucy, I'm so glad that you wrote this book. It's going to be, I think, a game changer for so many people that read it and try
Thank
to really.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Please go buy it. Please give it to your friends. Yeah. Anybody who feels stuck or who's been talked over, dismissed by a doctor who wants to be more empowered and not to be their own doctor, but to be a more empowered patient.
Yeah. And again, not just the doctor, even anyone in the system that's been part of that dismissal.
Nurse practitioner. PA. You know, yeah,
exactly. I feel like it's, you know, across the board, a problem in a system that doesn't want us to succeed.
That's right.
But thank you so much. It's a great book. I think it's very empowering and I think it's going to do well. And I appreciate you being on. Everyone go buy the book. The link will be in the bio. Thanks so much, Dr. Lucy McBride. Thank you for being here. All her information will be in the bio. Go follow her. Go read her Substack. My name is Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next.
Second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn
as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.